Die Presse.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge der Eastside Stories, dem Podcast des Magazins European Voices. Ich bin Martina Czarnowska.
Und ich bin Thomas Seifert. Ja, 2026 hat eben erst begonnen, doch es folgt offenbar dem Motto des berühmten Zitats von Wladimir Iljitsch Lenin. Und der soll gesagt haben, es gibt Jahrzehnte, in denen nichts passiert und es gibt Wochen, in denen Jahrzehnte passieren.
Ja, und solche Wochen haben wir wieder mal hinter uns gebracht. Zuletzt etwa beim Weltwirtschaftsforum in Davos.
Ganz genau. Das Treffen der globalen Elite wurde diesmal zum Schauplatz eines transatlantischen Schlagabtauschs, wie wir ihn in dieser Schärfe selten erlebt haben. Der US-Präsident Donald Trump hielt eine Rede, die an Klarheit, naja, vielleicht sollte ich besser sagen, an Unverfrorenheit nichts zu wünschen übrig ließ.
Er sagte wörtlich über Europa: Bestimmte Orte in Europa sind offen gesagt nicht mehr wiederzuerkennen. Sie zerstören sich selbst. Es sind wunderschöne, wunderschöne Orte.
Das war aber noch nicht alles. Deutschland, so Trump, produziere 22% weniger Strom als noch 2017. Und Großbritannien erzeuge nur mehr ein Drittel der Energie von 1999. Und das, obwohl es auf der Nordsee sitze, einer der größten Reserven der Welt, so Trump. Und überall in Europa stünden nun Windräder und, Zitat, das sind Loser, also Verlierer.
Besonders bemerkenswert war auch Trumps Schlussfolgerung. Die Vereinigten Staaten halten die ganze Welt über Wasser.
Und dann natürlich ging es auch um Grönland. Trump forderte wieder einmal die Übernahme der größten Insel der Welt und drohte mit Zöllen. Auf die bange Frage, ob er denn Gewalt anwenden würde, sagte er immerhin, ich werde keine Gewalt anwenden. Das war so Trump. Wohl die größte Aussage seiner Rede.
Die Europäer haben darauf geantwortet und diesmal ein bisschen deutlicher als viele Male zuvor.
Ja, Ursula von der Leyen sprach von europäischer Unabhängigkeit. Sie sagte, Zitat, ich war überrascht über die skeptischen Reaktionen, als ich diesen Begriff vor etwa einem Jahr verwendete. Aber weniger als ein Jahr später gibt es nun einen echten Konsens darüber. Europa werde, so von der Leyen, immer mit der Ukraine stehen und 90 Milliarden Dollar für 2026 und 2027 bereitstellen.
Aber nichtsdestotrotz sind die Brüche in der sogenannten westlichen Welt jedenfalls sicht- und fühlbar.
Absolut.
Die regelbasierte internationale Ordnung verblasst. Das ist wieder ein Zitat, und zwar des kanadischen Premierministers Mark Carney. Allerdings sagt er auch, Nostalgie ist keine Strategie. Die alte Ordnung kommt nicht zurück.
Carney wies in dieser Rede darauf hin, dass wir aus dem Bruch etwas Größeres, Besseres, Stärkeres, Gerechteres, so wieder das Zitat, aufbauen können.
Apropos aufbauen, machen wir wieder einen kleinen Gedankensprung. Wie sieht es eigentlich in jenen Ländern aus, die noch dabei sind, sich Europa anzunähern?
Ja, danke Martina. Wir sind ja immerhin der Podcast Eastside Stories, also kommen wir wieder in unsere Region zurück. Und natürlich wird auch das hier, was Trump gesagt hat und dieser Schlagabtausch auch dort wahrgenommen. Dazu haben wir jetzt eine WhatsApp aus Tirana bekommen. Klaidi, ein albanischer Absolvent des College of Europe, berichtet über die Stimmung in Albanien. Das Land arbeitet auf einen EU-Beitritt bis 2030 hin, und zwar nach 35 Jahren Warten. Und obwohl es nun nicht einmal mehr 5 Jahre sind, bis dorthin, sagt Klaidi, fühlt sich diese Zeit länger an als die 35, die bereits vergangen sind.
Hören wir uns also Klaidi selbst an.
Voice message. What's up, Tirana?
Përshëndetje, Çkemi from Tirana. So my name is Klaidi, and I'm an Albanian and a former student of the College of Europe here in Tirana campus. Well, everything in the last 2 years, let's say, it's all about 27 closing the EU negotiation chapters and then by 2030 to joining the EU. And although it's just 5 years from now, out of 35 years we've been waiting for the news, it still feels the longest 5 years we have to go through, although 35 have already passed. So I'd say that's a hint of how the vibe is right now. Well, I think it will happen for many reasons, some because of us, but mostly because of you or of them. So coming from Brussels and the other capitals. So I'm optimistic it will happen, but my concern now, although I feel like a black sheep at this moment, but it's mostly how to get prepared now that we're ready, what happens after the day of accession. So how we adapt and it doesn't become like a shock that hits us all once we join in 1st of January, let's say 2030.
Das also war Kleidi aus Tirana.
Er hat uns darauf hingewiesen, dass trotz aller Unkenrufe die EU noch immer Anziehungskraft besitzt. Das vergessen wir manchmal, weil wir uns auf die Schwächen dieses Gebildes konzentrieren.
Naja, es ist aber auch nicht gerade einfach, in dem derzeitigen globalen Machtgefüge Selbstbewusstsein zu bewahren. Da gilt vielleicht das Sprichwort, in einem Dschungel von lauter Raubtieren willst du vielleicht nicht der Vegetarier sein.
Und das, wenn auch nicht anhand dieses Beispieles, sondern anderer, war eins der Themen, die in unserem heutigen Gespräch aufgeworfen werden. Thomas, du hast mit der Politologin Natalie Tocci geredet.
Genau.
Und zwar am Rande des Time to Decide Summits der ersten Stiftung. Natalie Tocci ist Direktorin des Istituto Affari Internazionali in Rom. Sie beschreibt die aktuelle Lage Europas mit drastischen Worten. Es gebe einen Wettlauf um Europa. Dieses stehe auf dem kolonialen Speiseplan einer triangulären Bedrohung aus Russland, Trump-Amerika und den nationalistischen Kräften im Inneren. Was Europa vor allem fehle, sei Mut. Der Mut zu sagen, bis hierher und nicht weiter. Das Gespräch fand allerdings noch vor der jüngsten Eskalation rund um Grönland statt.
Naja, und da wirkt es ja so, als hätte die EU Tocis Vorschläge schon irgendwie ernster genommen und hat endlich klare Kante gezeigt. Aber zurück zum Interview. Ich habe Natalie Tocci also gefragt, is there something like a scramble for Europe?
Yeah, so firstly, I think that the answer very clearly is yes, right?
There is a scramble
for Europe. We are on the colonial menu, and there should be no doubt about this. And I think that coming back to my earlier point, we should understand this threat as not being just a threat from Russia, not just a betrayal of America, but a triangular threat. I call it the reverse J.D. Vance threat from within. Yeah, I mean, as you will recall, Vice President Vance at the Munich Security Conference talked about the threat from within. And of course, he was referring to the threat of these dangerous woke liberals. The real threat from within are precisely the nationalist far-right forces within Europe, which, as I said, are being supported by Putin and by Trump because they serve the purpose of that scramble for Europe. So there's a triangle of threats at the moment going on. Firstly, well, a couple of reflections. Should we think of China as belonging to the same sort of group? On one level, yes, and on another, no. I don't think that China is actually on a mission to colonize Europe. Yes, I think that we rightly woke up to the strategic edge behind initiatives like Belt and Road. It is clear that China will try and extract as much as possible, but I don't think it's in the business of, let's say, territorial expansion in the way in which Russia is, or even the United States. You know, we now no longer talk about Greenland anymore, but Trump actually does want to actually, occupy and invade Greenland. So, you know, it's a different nature of the threat, which doesn't mean that we should lower the guard vis-a-vis China. But it does mean, I think, firstly, that it's a question of prioritizing. We can't take on everyone at the same time. And secondly, we need to understand that we are now confronting the China challenge alone. Up until when there was a strong transatlantic bond and we lived in the democracy autocracy paradigm, it was us and America against, quote unquote, Russia and China. We can't at the same time be alone against everyone at the same time, especially when actually what is happening is an, let's call it, imperial collusion between China, the US, and Russia. So I think we firstly need to understand that it's a different context that we operate in, prioritize, understand what is the most immediate threat, not necessarily therefore become naive when it comes to China, but simply understand the different predicament that we're in today.
And so I asked her about the external threats, that they might be actually the easier challenge. The internal ones are the harder ones, because these are European democratic forces with real popular support in their respective countries. Natalie Tocci is from Italy, so I asked her what is the meaningful difference between Meloni from Italy, Orban from Hungary, and a potentially far-right French President Bardella. How will the European Union navigate this? because these parties now form a kind of a new internationale, yet with an arguably greater internal divergence than the socialist one ever had.
Yes, but I don't think that we should conclude from this that there are moderate far-right leaders and radical far-right leaders. They are all far-right leaders. And I tend to make the distinction more between smart ones and stupid ones, incremental ones, and abrupt ones. Generally, the smart ones are incremental. They do things step by step. Incidentally, Orban himself, which today is obviously sort of a very extreme version, but Orban in 2010, when he was elected, did not appear to be particularly extreme. He was actually incremental, right? And what happens with the incrementalism is that you step by step, as often as you can, under the radar, no one notices, you actually shift the country. You take on the judiciary, you take on the free media, you basically take on all of the institutions that make up a liberal democracy, and then you can afford to lower the mask, right? And become the radical self that you are. Now, I actually think that today it may look like Meloni is more moderate than Orban. I don't think this is the case at all. Now, of course, there are different circumstances, right? Of course, in Italy is a bigger country. It's more dependent on foreign markets. It has a very solid constitution. It has a strong president of the republic. It has strong institutions. So the constraints on Meloni are greater. But the direction of travel is exactly the same, right? All Meloni has had to do is to say that she supports Ukraine. Does anyone actually look at how much support Italy is providing to Ukraine? Not very much at all. Does anyone, therefore, given that we all think this is fantastic, she supports Ukraine, actually look at the way in which she's step by step undermining the independence of the judiciary, the free media, right? So I think that we should look at this phenomenon in a, sort of in a nuanced way. Yes, look at the differences, but not necessarily think, therefore we can work with Meloni and not with Orban. We need to understand that while the differences are there, the direction of travel is the same.
I asked her, for years, opportunism pushed European leaders towards the center, towards Brussels, towards European integration, because that's where the benefits were. But now something has shifted. To use a physics metaphor, if the EU was the stronger magnet attracting these political actors, what has actually changed? How did the opposing magnet, Russia, nationalist movements, Euroscepticism, suddenly become strong enough to pull countries like Hungary, Slovakia, or even Italy in a different direction? What explains this realignment?
I think that there are different bits to this answer. I mean, firstly, I do think, coming back to, I think, the first part of your earlier question, of course, there are answers which are considered to be inadequate, right? And until and unless we do find, indeed, not just a vision aimed at conserving the old, but at building the new, until we find a new energizing liberal project for Europe, inevitably we're always going to be on the defensive, right? So, this conversation needs to start with the mistakes that were made and needs to start with new solutions to be put on the table. Now, having said this, I think it's also important to point out that going back to the opportunism, many of these leaders, many of these governments can have their cake and eat it too, right? You can do the Europe bashing and the cuddling up to Russia, but still get the benefits from Europe, right?
So you say a price needs to be inflicted.
Absolutely. But this requires the development of spine. I think if there is one thing, if you were to ask me, you know, what's the one thing that is really missing in Europe, I would say courage. The courage at some point to say, you know what, that's the door. The courage not to, you know, whether it's Trump, whether it's Orban, I'm not saying, you know, here we are, we should be giving the middle finger to everyone. but simply to keep your back straight a little bit more and to say, this is the red line and we will not go beyond it. There needs to be, as you say, prices to be paid and consequences. You know, you can make a bet and make a losing bet, but at least you've kind of made a choice. At the moment, if you simply capitulate on one issue after another, inevitably you're going to be considered, whether it's by Trump or by Putin, colonizable, or whether it's by Orban, basically simply something to opportunistically play with.
So my question was, Europe has a powerful story to tell, peace, prosperity, cooperation, but it's evidently not cutting through. The nationalist narratives are winning in France, the AfD in Germany, the FPÖ in Austria. What do we do about that? Where does Europe find stories that actually resonate with the people?
Well, so I come back to a point that I was making earlier. I think we haven't done well enough in exposing the unpatriotic dimension of what the far right is doing. So if you were to ask me, what is Europe's story today? I would tell you it's the global story, obvious, right? So it's no longer peace on the continent after two world wars. It's no longer prosperity through the single market. Not that these things are not important, but the big story of why is it that we should be together is because of the US and China and Russia and multipolarity. This is why all of our countries, big and small, are all tiny. Yeah, we're all small, fat chicken in the jungle. So this is, I think, something that is intuitive. I think people understand it. I'm sure it's like this in Austria as well. In Italy, up until 3-4 years ago, no one talked about foreign policy, right? When I, you know, people used to ask me, what do you work on? Foreign policy, international relations. They kind of thought maybe I was some sort of hostess or something, right? So yeah, now everyone understands it. This is part of everyone's dinner table. So I actually think it's very intuitive for people to understand that Europe has to be together. But until and unless we expose the fact that the sort of populist internationalist or populist European is actually a project of disintegration, we need to first make it clear this is about disintegration. Disintegration means the scramble for Europe, means being on the colonial menu, right? And only then are you able to actually offer, in a sense, a vision of a global Europe.
So following your line of thought, I asked, when you look at the map, this wave of populism appears concentrated in Catholic countries. There's almost something like a Habsburg pattern here. Austria barely escaped the nationalist pool. Slovakia and Hungary have fallen, Hungary a long time ago. And the Czech Republic is wobbling. What do you think explains this? I asked her.
Yeah, I mean, it's a super difficult question to address. I mean, I think it is, on the one hand, there is obviously the obvious explanation of it's about education and the educational divide. Incidentally, I mean, if you think about the United States, right, and the vote in the United States, you see that actually the principal explanatory factor of the election in 2024 was the educational divide. So there's something to do with education, which then overlaps with urban, rural, and I wouldn't say it's culture qua culture, but the way in which culture can be more easily manipulated, in a sense, in certain social, geographic, etc. contexts. So probably there's that as probably if one is to say, you know, pick on one factor that applies to all of these countries. But then indeed, I think, you know, once you start getting into the individual histories of different countries, there are different explanations. Yeah. In Spain, I think, you know, the contrast, for instance, let's take Spain and Italy. Very interesting the way in which both countries have a similar problem, but it manifests itself in completely different ways. The similar problem was that Spain and Italy, unlike Germany, and Austria didn't actually go through a sort of denazification process after the Second World War, right? So in a sense, you know, in Italy, kind of Italiani brava gente, and kind of papering over. I mean, it was just kind of Mussolini that kind of took the wrong turn when he allied with Hitler. Otherwise, it would have been all fine, right? So, and same goes to Spain. There was never a defrancoization of the system. So in a sense, similar problems, and you have the far right that basically filters into that history, however, manifests itself in very different ways. In the case of Spain, as we're seeing now, with all of this kind of, you know, the attack on the Socialist Party from the judiciary, a lot has to do with the fact that the judiciary itself was never defrancoized. Right. In Italy, the judiciary is actually considered one of the bastions of liberal democracy in the country. And in fact, the right would accuse it of being too close to the left. Right. So similar histories that institutionally then operate in very different ways. And I think, you know, one can go through these different stories. So, you know, upon the overall general story of the educational divide and rural, urban, and da-da-da-da, you have these individual histories that then manifest themselves in very different ways.
Well, and then I asked about former Trump campaigner Steve Bannon, who said politics is downstream from culture, and the populists are acting on it. And I said, well, look at Budapest and Bratislava. Cultural institutions are under siege. Europe's cultural richness makes it even more vulnerable than the US in this regard. So how do we defend these bastions, I asked. Media, artists, intellectuals, universities.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the starting place is to recognize that these are the institutions that are being attacked, and they're being attacked for a reason. Right. So I think that whether it's the artists, the journalists, that they need to understand that they are not simply observers of the situation. They're on the front line. And once you understand that you're on the front line, in a sense, agency has a possibility of emerging. And agency then manifests itself through the building of alliances, through the building of coalitions, I mean, through the understanding that we're part of the same fight. If you simply think, you know, you're a journalist and you're looking at this, yeah, as some sort of alien from Mars, then inevitably you're going to end up on that scramble without even noticing that you were, right? So I think, you know, it is super important to understand that these are forces that can beat opposition parties very easily in elections. This is why their main opposition are precisely the institutions that we're talking about, which requires these institutions, these bodies, culture, to understand that they are at the front line, not simply in the rear seat of this fight.
Den Link zu unserem Gespräch mit Natalie Tocci finden Sie in den Shownotes.
Ebenso Informationen zur aktuellen Ausgabe unserer European Voices.
Das war Kapitel 11 unserer East Side Stories. Jeden letzten Donnerstag im Monat erscheint eine neue Podcast-Folge.
Schön, dass Sie dabei waren.
Hören Sie uns wieder.
Servus.
Dos wahrscheinlich, ja.